All right, everybody, welcome back to Didactic Mind, episode 42, Poison is the Cure. Very warm welcome to all of my longtime readers, all of my SoundCloud subscribers, if you're new to either my blog or to my podcast. Please make sure you hit the subscribe button and make sure you visit the blog, stop by, leave a comment, like and subscribe as you please, share around the articles. And get the word out, because the message that people like me try to bring to the world is fundamentally one of hope and one of truth. But it's very easy for us to be suppressed and squelched by basically big corporations who really don't want us to say what is true. Now, they have ulterior motives for that, obviously, and I'm going to address some of that in this podcast today, because it's going to be all about Big Pharma and the results of years and years and years of nonsense and stupidity peddled by Big Pharma on behalf of their profit line. Now, before I get started, if you want to support my work, go visit a website called superbshaving.com. Link is in the description box. It's all about what it takes to look your best with traditional wet shaving. It'll save you a huge amount of money in the long run. You get lots of affiliate links to various Amazon products. And once I find the time, over the next couple of weeks, I hope, it will be undergoing something of a revamp in terms of the look and feel of the site. There will also be, eventually, again, it's a matter of finding the time, a couple of other websites coming up, didacticstrength.com. The blog itself will be moving to a new site called Didactic Mind, didacticmind.com, because, hey, why not? And I'm not going to give away anything right now, but there should be a rather interesting new product coming on the market soon, within the next month or so, which will be of particular interest to some of my younger readers and listeners, I think. So we're going to get to that whenever it gets released, but just keep an eye out for that, and there will be announcements on my blog, on SoundCloud, etc., etc. SoundCloud itself, I mean, you know, I've got a subscription to SoundCloud for 2 years, and I will stay with it until my subscription runs out, but eventually I will be more than happy to move away from SoundCloud, because SoundCloud has made it very clear that they stand with the Black Looming Menace, and I have absolutely no intention of giving any more of my money to people who hate Western civilization. So, with that in mind, I wanted to talk today about what Big Pharma has done to us as consumers and customers. Now, a lot of people who get started on the start going down these rabbit holes with respect to medicine and pharmacology really get a bit too caught up in the unhinged aspects of things. I want to make this very clear. I am not against drug companies. I don't really have a problem with them. In fact, I'm happy to openly admit I have significant investments in companies with large pharmaceutical departments. A significant portion of my personal portfolio is invested in one very large multinational company that has a significant stake in multiple pharmaceutical companies. In fact, it is composed of a huge agglomeration of consumer products, medical devices, and pharmaceuticals. And that's not the only such company that I have in my portfolio. And I have no problem whatsoever with the existence of big pharma companies like Merck, Pfizer, Eli Lilly, what's the other one? Procter & Gamble, obviously. Who is it that makes Remdesivir? I forget. Gilead, of course. GlaxoSmithKline, or which used to be like Glaxo Wellcome, and then SmithKline Beecham, and they merged to form one Mongo company. I don't have any problem whatsoever with the existence of these companies. They have been responsible for some of the greatest breakthroughs in medical science that we've ever seen in human history. The medical profession today would not be what it is without these companies, their innovations, and the billions upon billions upon billions of dollars that they have invested in furthering life-saving research and expanding the frontiers of what is possible in healthcare. So this is, what I'm going to say is not the unhinged rantings of someone who hates pharmaceuticals and who promotes alternative medicine. It's not me. That's not what I believe in. I believe that the Western ways of medicine are by far the most effective, the most useful, the most well-researched, well-documented. Does that mean that I ignore alternatives that are out there? No, not necessarily. There are plenty of alternative therapies available. I think people should have the right to pick and choose what works best for them. But where I draw great objection to Big Pharma is when they sell us drugs that do nothing, cost enormous amounts of money, and in fact have very, very adverse side effects. And this comes back to the title of this podcast, Poison is the Cure. It's not just a play on words. It's not. It has to do with the very origins of the word pharmacology. The etymology of this word is a Greek compound word called pharmakon. Pharma and kon means, when put together, is a compound word that basically means either cure or poison. It's the same word for two different concepts. Why is that? Because the ancient Greeks recognized quite well, dating back to the days of Aesculapius and Hippocrates, that if you introduce foreign substances into the human body, those foreign substances may well be a cure for certain things, but they may well also be a poison for others. We look back at the ancients and we laugh at the idea that you could give people arsenic to cure certain diseases, which is what they did. We look back and giggle at the idea of trepanation, which is basically, it's a quite a ghastly procedure, but essentially it comes down to removing fragments of the skull. Literally, someone would take a hammer and chisel, and remember, this was in the days well before anesthesia, so the victim was quite alive and awake when this would happen. Drill a hole into the bone of the skull and remove a disc of skull, and in the process probably remove some brain matter as well. Needless to say, this was a highly traumatic, incredibly painful, horrifying way of treating anything. We look back at this idea of medicine being all about vapors and humors and bloodletting and leeches, and we think, wow, that's redonkulous. I mean, how stupid were they back then that they would believe in this stuff? Well, remember, this was all before germ theory came along and explained how bacteria and microorganisms affect our daily life and our environment and our health. But the ancients weren't quite as stupid as we think they were these days. Compared to our modern enlightened ways of medicine, some of them were actually very wise, and some of them had come up with cures that were remarkable for their time. Moving to more modern times, I'll give you a very simple example. Alexander Fleming is usually credited with coming or discovering penicillin, which is basically a fungus. It's a type of mold. He sneezed into a petri dish and watched fungus grow on it and was like, huh, the fungus eat the bacteria that caused my sickness. Interesting. And from that, we got all of the antibiotics that we now have today. But the Turks, of all people, the Ottoman Turks, surprisingly, given the anti-scientific nature of Islam and given the incredibly regressive and backward worldview that Islam fosters on people, actually were able to figure out a much more sort of ancient version of that same idea. What they would do is they would pack bread underneath the saddles of the horses of their janissaries and their troops, their cavalry, basically. And as the horses would sweat during marches and rides, the bread would, of course, become waterlogged and eventually become breeding grounds for fungus. And that fungus, as it turns out, that particular type or strain of fungus was very useful because when their janissaries suffered from trauma, from wounds in battle, they would pack that moldy bread right into the wounds to stop infection. Now, they couldn't explain how it stopped infection. They just knew that it did, and it worked. So these ideas have percolated for many centuries, and it took the modern way of doing things to create big pharmaceutical corporations that could use those same ideas and bring them into the world as life-saving medicines marketed under specific brands and specific usages, specific dosages. But somewhere along the line, the very system that created those life-saving drugs, and they were absolutely life-saving, the world would never be the same, would not be the same today if it were not for things like penicillin and antibiotics, or for painkillers, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or for even steroidal, or I should say opioid drugs. The world would not be the same as it is today. I mean, most people don't realize this, but opioids and heroin have the same origin. They come, the chemicals used to create OxyContin, Vicodin, codeine, and a few other very, very powerful painkillers are all derived from the poppy plant. Guess what else is derived from the poppy plant? Heroin. Which is why, I mean, poppy milk and poppy seeds have been known to be narcotic and have had narcotic influences throughout all of history. They've been used as anesthetics by doctors in the past, by medicine men in ancient times. So this stuff is not new. It's just that we've taken that idea and refined it and cultured it and created a system around it by which we can market these drugs to the public. Somewhere along the line, however, something has gone very, very horribly wrong. And we're now at the point where drugs are being sold on the market that are vastly expensive and that have no real benefit. An interesting article came across my feed, or I was actually not my feed, but I was surfing the RT.com website. If you're not on RT.com, highly recommend it. Presents a very useful and viable alternative to the endlessly one-sided lying media of the American West and of much of the rest of the West. Why? Because RT.com relies on fundamentally different news sources. I mean, yes, they use the Associated Press and Agence France-Presse to derive a lot of their raw information. But the Russians also have a fairly sophisticated news-gathering organization of their own. They have several news agencies, Itartas and a few others, which generate a very different point of view, and that's a very good thing. And you'll find on RT a number of non-traditional voices and non-standard ideas that you just don't get in the Western media. And it's useful to have that perspective because the Western media, at least the mainstream media, is just, it's packed full of liars and charlatans and frauds. And it is with very good reason that I have a shirt, which I wear to the gym, in fact, so people can see it, you can see the writing on the back. And on the back of that shirt, it says, "Rope, tree, journalist. Some assembly required." I genuinely do believe that. I mean, I'm not usually in favor of lining people and having them tried up, lining up people and having them tried for treason en masse. But when it comes to most Western journalists, I really do believe that's necessary at this point. I really do think that Western journalists have reached such a low level of honesty and transparency, and such a low level of overall intelligence, and such a deep level of malfeasance and treacherous conduct, that they need to be lined up and tried for treason, and if they are found guilty, shot for it. I really do believe that at this point. It's just gotten so bad. But the article that I read was by a chap named Dr. Malcolm Kendrick, and he works as a GP in the NHS, the National Health Service in England. Now, say what you will about the NHS, as far as I'm concerned, their system is utterly broken. The NHS is a wonderful example of what happens when you impose socialism on an entire organization. It doesn't work. It's bloated. It's overly corrupted. It's hugely expensive. It prioritizes basically rationing healthcare over actually providing good healthcare outcomes. And it has been lionized and feted by the British public and their politicians, even though everybody involved at every level knows it's broken. It's such a powerful and entrenched system that you can't do anything about it. But Dr. Kendrick had some very fascinating things to say about statins. Now, for those of you who don't know, statins are drugs, very powerful drugs, designed to lower your cholesterol, or at least that's how they're marketed. Statins, however, don't do one damn thing to lower your actual cholesterol level. What they do is target your existing levels of lipoproteins, which are not cholesterol. Now, what he's saying in this article is pretty fascinating. I'll read from a bit of it. New research shows that the most widely prescribed type of drug in the history of medicine is a waste of money. One major study found that the more bad cholesterol was lowered, the greater the risk of heart attacks and strokes. In the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, almost every other medical condition has been shoved on the sidelines. However, in the UK last year, heart attacks and strokes, parenthetically CVD or cardiovascular disease, killed well over 100,000 people, which is at least twice as many as have died from COVID-19. And he basically goes on to say that one of the most significant and of great interest to me personally was a critical examination of the benefits of lowering cholesterol. This was published on August 4th. The paper was called Hit or Miss, the New Cholesterol Targets, and came out in Evidence-Based Medicine, one of the key titles that sits under the umbrella of British Medical Journal Publishing. It was carefully worded, as all clinical papers are, but a key section of the press release was as follows. Quote, setting targets for bad LDL cholesterol levels to ward off heart disease and death in those at risk might seem intuitive, but decades of research have failed to show any consistent benefit for this approach, reveals an analysis of the available data published online in BMJ Evidence-Based Medicine. So, what does this mean? Okay, we'll need to take a step back and look at some background. And if you have the time, I highly recommend going to YouTube, I think it's still there, and looking up a documentary called Fathead, which was a response to Morgan Spurlock's Supersize Me. And Morgan Spurlock's Supersize Me was all about how horrible fast food is for you and how evil the fast food companies are for peddling this stuff. It's like it's worse than smoking. It's stupid. It's food marketed to the weak and the dumb, and they're really taking advantage of naive Americans and making them chunkier and heavier in the process. And it's all so evil. And the chap behind Fathead basically said, "Well, you know what? I'm not so convinced. I really want to test this out. I want to see if eating junk food might actually be beneficial." And that's what he did. He went and ate pretty much nothing but junk food for a month, which is to say protein-rich, fat-heavy diet of McDonald's, Popeyes, Burger King, Wendy's, Jack in the Box, or I don't know. I mean, I'm out of touch with American fast food brands. I like to cook my own food, and I like to make it fresh. But yeah, you get the idea. Basically, just eat junk food for a long time. And the results of that documentary showed that his health outcomes actually improved. Why? Because he switched from a diet that was heavy on carbohydrates to a diet that was heavy on fat and protein mixed in with a fair chunk of carbohydrates. And he lowered his cholesterol in the process. Well, again, not cholesterol. He lowered his LDL. He lost weight, and his overall health improved. And his doctor was shocked. He was gobsmacked at the end of the documentary. It's like, that doesn't make sense. This doesn't jibe with what I've been taught. Well, yeah, because what doctors and most people have been taught for 50 years has been utterly wrong. The entirety of the medical establishment, pretty much, is guilty of malfeasance and fraud on a scale that we've really not seen before. Only journalists, I think, are worse in this respect. Now, to understand why statins are ineffective, we have to go back a very long way. We have to go back to a study by Dr. Ansel Keys, which eventually became known as the Seven Countries Study. And it is the foundation of what is known as the lipid hypothesis, which is the entire basis for the modern, or until fairly recently, the modern idea that fat is bad and cholesterol is bad and evil, and people are better off eating a low-fat, low-cholesterol diet. The lipid hypothesis was Dr. Keyes' attempt at showing a clear trend line between countries that have high rates of cardiovascular disease, basically high rates of heart attacks, and consumption of saturated fat in the diets. And he took seven countries, and he plotted these data points in a nice graph, and it seemed to show a very clear trend line. It seemed to show that the more saturated fat was in the diet of individuals from a particular country, the higher their incidence of heart disease. It was a fairly obvious-looking statistical trend. And if you ran a regression analysis on those seven data points, you'd be like, oh, wow, yeah, that's pretty high R-squared, pretty high correlation. Therefore, his theory must be right, and we should all adopt a low-fat, high-carb, low-cholesterol diet to lower our saturated fat intake and thereby reduce our incidence of heart attacks. Just one problem. That entire theory was cut from whole cloth. It's nonsense. That study really should have been called the 21 country study, because that's the actual data set he had. He had 21 countries worth of data. And instead of showing all 21 countries on the graph, he cherry-picked. He showed only 7 countries worth of data. What would have happened if he'd shown all 21 countries? The trend line would have disappeared. There would have been no obvious trend whatsoever, because you would have had countries with relatively low intakes of saturated fat, such as Japan, and low levels of heart disease. Yes, okay, that's fine. But then what about France? France has a very high level of saturated fat consumption and very low rate of heart disease. What about Britain? At the time, Britain had a very relatively high level of saturated fat consumption and relatively high rate of heart disease. What about America? Same story. What about other countries around the world? The trend disappeared completely, which meant that saturated fat was not the primary cause of heart disease. It wasn't even close. Furthermore, what's become absolutely evident over the last 50 or so years is that as consumption of grains has increased, because we've switched as human beings from a high-fat, high-protein diet to a low-fat, high-carb diet, the rate of heart disease has skyrocketed across the world. The rate of diabetes has skyrocketed. So something's not right. Something's not adding up. What is going on? Why don't we see the evidence? Why are we constantly being told by every aspect of the medical establishment, from the U.S. Food and Drugs Administration to the big pharma companies to the educational establishment all the way on down that fat is bad and carbs are good. If you've ever seen the food pyramid, you look at the, you know, the infamous US USDA or US FDA food pyramid. The bottom of that pyramid is all starches, rice, pasta, bread. And the top of that pyramid, or close to the top, is meat, fish, and fat. That pyramid should have been inverted from the beginning. It's absolute garbage. There's no scientific basis for it whatsoever. Why is it that today we see so much propaganda aimed at us saying that fat is bad for you? I mean, until fairly recently, it's only been in the last 10 years or so that the scientific literature has finally come around and said, yeah, you know what, stick our hands up, we done screwed up, that we were wrong. Why did it take 50 years for that to happen? Well, a big part of it has to do with George McGovern, Senator George McGovern, utterly failed presidential candidate who got wiped out, I think, by Richard Nixon. Is that right? No, sorry. My mistake. Not Richard Nixon. I think that was Hubert Humphreys. But George McGovern, utterly, totally failed presidential candidate who, I think, what did he do? He ran, my American listeners can correct me on this, I'm sure, but I think he ran a primary against Jimmy Carter and fatally wounded Jimmy Carter's re-election bid against the legendary St. Ronald Magnus of the right. And the reason why a lot of this nonsense has since become codified is because George McGovern held hearings on Capitol Hill back in the 70s, back when he was on himself on a low-fat diet. And he there's footage of him in those hearings basically telling people, telling doctors, we don't really have time to wait on the evidence. I mean, the doctors are sitting there in the hearing begging him, saying, Senator, I implore you, we don't have the research, we don't have the data yet to support this theory. We cannot say to you definitively that consumption of eggs, which was the subject of the hearing at the time, is linked to higher rates of heart disease. We don't have the evidence in front of us. We need time to do the research. And George McGovern is sitting there, the footage is right there, it's fully available, and he's sitting there and he's basically saying, look, doctor, I'm sure you know you have the interest of the medical community at heart, but I'm telling you as a politician, we don't really have the time to wait on the research. We don't have the ability to sit here and we don't have the luxury of time. So because of George McGovern, guidance from the US government was issued saying that saturated fat is bad for you. But it's not. To understand why it's not bad for you, you have to understand the mechanism of how cholesterol is produced in the body. Now, disclaimer, I am not a doctor. I don't claim to be a medical expert. I'm not even remotely close to a medical expert. So don't, I mean, if I say something wrong, that's on me. I'm sorry. I humbly apologize. I'm just relaying the information that I have learned as best as I am able. If I make a mistake, my fault. Totally my responsibility. Don't believe anything you hear coming from me without going away and doing your own research. And I'm happy to provide some links and context and background. But don't believe, don't take for granted one single word that I say about anything, because I'm just human. So if I make a mistake, go look at it for yourself. Go look at the information. It's all out there. And see for yourself and make up your own mind. I'm just trying to provide you with a different point of view. That being said, how does cholesterol work in the body? Well, basically, cholesterol is produced by every single cell in your body. It's actually essential for life, for human life to exist. You cannot be alive if your cholesterol is low. It's essential for every aspect of your health, whether it's your immune system, your cardiovascular system, your liver, your pancreas, your kidneys. Every single aspect of your health depends upon production of cholesterol. What is it that produces cholesterol? Because every single cell in your body is a cholesterol-producing factory. What is it that helps you increase your production of cholesterol? It is the presence of saturated fat in the body. I don't pretend to understand how. Again, not a doctor. But that's the link. When you have more saturated fat in your diet, you have more cholesterol. Now, what is it that these statins are supposed to fight? is it cholesterol? No, it's not. It's actually low-density lipoprotein. Now, this is where the average person's understanding of the situation is really needs some significant revision. Cholesterol is not the problem, and statins don't target cholesterol. We're told that cholesterol is the problem, but that's absolute bullshit. It's not. What people actually measure, when you go to the doctor's office and he takes blood tests for your annual physical and he measures your quote-unquote cholesterol levels, what's actually happening is the blood test draws blood and it measures the amount of lipoproteins and triglycerides in your blood. And as a general rule, high-density lipoproteins are considered good and low-density lipoproteins are considered bad. And you also have triglycerides floating around. I don't pretend to understand what they do. I'm not going to speculate on it. But what they actually do is these lipoproteins act as cell repair mechanisms. essentially, the medical establishment used to blame cholesterol for the buildup of plaque in your arteries, for blocking up your arteries. But that's not actually what happens. What actually happens is high-density lipoproteins basically have no problems with passing through the cell walls of your arteries. Low-density lipoproteins come in two forms, not one form, but two forms, LDL-A and LDL-B. LDL-A comes in the form of these big sort of fluffy balls, almost like cotton balls, basically. And they're really pretty benign. That doesn't actually do much of anything. LDL-B is in these small little packets that stick to the cell walls and have a hard time passing through. Now, when the walls of your blood vessels, particularly the arteries around your heart, experience trauma, experience, irritation. It's not irritation, sorry. There's a specific word for it, which I'm completely drawing a blank on right now. But basically, when there's some sort of stress on the arterial walls and they become damaged, the LDL is sent, dispatched into that area, and LDL-B starts to stick to those walls and build up upon them in order to save that cellular wall, that membrane. The result is, over time, you get plaque buildup. Okay? Now, why is that a bad thing? Well, obviously, over time, if enough plaque builds up, the artery gets blocked, and that causes severe and significant disruption of blood flow into the heart, out of the heart, and that results in a heart attack. How do you fix that? Well, you can insert a stent, you can go in and actually do a bypass surgery, you can scoop out the plaque that's filling up the walls of your artery that's clogging things up. All of this is very traumatic. Stent surgery isn't. Stent surgery is minimally invasive, so it's not so bad. But bypass surgery is highly invasive. They literally crack open your chest. They break your sternum. They crack open the chest, and they go in and do a bypass surgery on that, and it's like miserable. The recovery time is very long and very unpleasant. But why is it that these statins are marketed to us, telling us that they will fix the problem? They don't do anything to fix the problem. When you go to a doctor and you get your cholesterol checked out, he'll give you three numbers, HDL, LDL, and triglycerides, and then you get your overall cholesterol ratio, which is to say that your HDL divided by the sum of your LDL and triglycerides. And if you have a ratio of greater than, I think, 5, that's considered phenomenal. If you have a very low ratio, then that's considered a problem. Well, here's the thing. People who eat lots of saturated fat, you know, lots of red meat, lots of lard, lots of butter, lots of coconut oil, lots of different omega-3 fatty acids through fish and stuff like that, they have very high, quote-unquote, cholesterol. But guess what? It's all good cholesterol. It's all HDL. And I distinctly remember when I was about 20 years old or so being told, oh, it's all down to your genetics. It's not down to your genetics. It's not. It's not down to your genetics. That's bullshit. It's down to your diet. That's what matters. If you're eating a diet very high in starches and wheat and bread and rice and pasta and stuff like that, and you're eating a diet low in fruits, vegetables, and meat, fish, proteins, high-density proteins, high-quality proteins, then you're in a lot of trouble. You're basically consuming stuff that is designed to react with your metabolic system and make you fat. And if you want to know the exact mechanism for that, go watch the documentary Fathead. It's got a great explanation of exactly how your body breaks down the glucose compounds in these high starch foods and how that causes significant problems with buildup of fat cells. Now, why then is Big Pharma selling us a cure if it doesn't work? Well, the simple answer is because it makes money. They have essentially perpetuated a scam throughout the last 50 years or so for a product that doesn't work. And it's not even that they're lying about it, because they're not. If you actually look at the fine print below a product ad for a statin, such as Lipitor, okay? Lipitor is a multi-billion dollar drug. But if you watch the TV ads for Lipitor, and you really zoom in on the fine print with like a freaking magnifying glass, you'll find something very interesting buried in the fine print. It says, Lipitor has not been proven effective in women over the age of 55. And that's true. It hasn't. Clinical studies have shown no benefit whatsoever in terms of cardiovascular disease and incidence thereof in women over the age of 55. And yet, this is a tremendously powerful drug that has some very nasty side effects. Do you know what the most commonly reported side effect is for men who take Lipitor or statins in general? Erectile dysfunction. Do you know who markets the best-selling drug for erectile dysfunction? Viagra. The same people who make Lipitor. That should give you some idea of why it is that these companies are pushing these drugs. Because they are effective at one thing: making gigantic amounts of money. These drugs, when taken in combination, are not good for you. When taken alone, they're not good for you. Viagra is terrible for men. A lot of the problems introduced by, or a lot of the problems that Viagra is supposed to solve, can be solved through other methods, which don't have potentially disastrous side effects, which may not cause you to have a heart attack. Viagra is basically, it was originally intended as some sort of, I could be wrong about, I'm probably wrong about this, some sort of antidepressant which would work by increasing blood flow, right? It was a blood thinning drug. And it eventually turned out to be a muscle relaxant. And that muscle relaxant happens to work on erectile tissue within men. And it just so happened that researchers discovered this. They're like, holy shit, we're sitting on a gold mine. Which they were. But a lot of the issues that Viagra is supposed to treat, which, by the way, they discovered completely by accident, as a lot of these medicines are discovered, a lot of those can be treated naturally. And I'm not talking about any hippy-dippy, stupid alternative medicine, one with the universe kind of nonsense, Deepak Chopra-type cures. I can't stand that bullshit. I'm talking about simple changes to your diet, taking nitric oxide supplements, using pumps, using basically ultrasound treatments to break down plaque within the tissues, all right? All of that stuff is much more affordable than taking Viagra and much less likely to kill you. Why then are these companies still in business doing this stuff? Because we let them. Fundamentally, we let them. We have a trust issue as human beings. We trust our doctors because they've gone to medical school and they know how all this stuff works and they have built a reputation and a practice on doing this stuff. And we expect that they know the latest in the medical literature and they are well-read and well-versed and well-informed. Well, here's the reality. Most of these doctors don't have a clue. They are just going based on what they're taught. There's another great documentary on Netflix called Prescription Thugs. And it's by Chris Bell, who is the middle brother between legendary powerlifter Mark Bell and the sadly deceased Mike Bell, who Mike Mad Dog Bell, who was basically a jobber in the WWE and World Wrestling Entertainment, Worldwide Wrestling Entertainment, whatever it's called. And he died of a drug overdose. His older brother died of a drug overdose some years ago. And that the death of his brother inspired Chris Bell to make this documentary about the dangers of prescription drugs and the lethality of some of these drugs and their toxic side effects upon the people who take them. I've watched it multiple times, a very powerful documentary, and well worth watching, I highly recommend it. It starts off talking about painkillers and how addictive opioid painkillers are. And it goes into other classes of drugs, such as statins, which are, as we've seen, totally useless. It goes into antidepressant drugs, SSRIs. If you've ever known anyone on antidepressants, and I have, you'll know that antidepressants severely screw with your personality or with the personality of the people taking them. SSRIs significantly rewire your brain because they're designed to increase serotonin receptivity. And that is, while they have benefits, no doubt, the moment you're on them, you're pretty much on them for life. And that's a very, very scary prospect. If you try to go cold turkey off of SSRIs, off of antidepressant medication, that is the worst thing you can possibly do. There have been a number of really tragic, horrifying suicides linked to people who got off these medications. And these medications have some very, very dangerous side effects, very powerful side effects. I personally knew a guy who had bipolar disorder. I wrote about him on my blog. I never named him, and I won't name him here out of respect for his family. But back in 2011, when I started working for a big German bank in New York, I was brought in to replace a man with significant medical problems. I was told he had gone on long-term disability, which is to say he had taken 6 months off to treat a medical condition. And he did. He had. And it was a very, very difficult learning experience for me. I had to come right up an incredibly steep curve, but I eventually made it. And I started in November 2011. And by about May 2012, he had come back into the group, into the team. And I was pretty pissed at him for leaving, and I made my displeasure with him very clear from the outset. But it turns out he was a really good guy, and really nice guy, and he basically apologized to me, and he said, "Look, I just had a lot of crap to deal with, and I'm really sorry about what happened, but I'm back, I'm here to work, I'm here to get on with things." And he seemed like he'd gotten his life back together. I later learned that he had serious bipolar disorder, manic depressive problems, basically. And anyone who knows anything about bipolar disorder knows that when you go through manic depressive phases, the manic phases are highs beyond anything you can imagine. I mean, the people who go into the manic phases are like, they can stay awake for days at a time, they can run marathons, they can train for triathlons, they can work endlessly, they can talk ridiculous lengths, to the point where it's just white noise coming from them. But to them, it makes perfect sense. To people listening to them, it's like, dude, shut up. You've just been talking for like 10 hours straight. Anybody who saw Kanye West's sort of rally recently knows what I'm on about. The manic depressive, the manic phase results in just completely off the wall thoughts bouncing around everywhere. That phase is followed by the lowest of lows. Winston Churchill called it the black dog depressions because he had bipolar disorder as well. And it is depression, crushing depression beyond anything you can imagine. I mean, I've been pretty depressed in my life due to shit that's happened. That's really crushed me. But I've always been able to look past it and see hope. And as bad as some of it got, it never got chronic. It was never like, my life is over, I'm just going to stay in bed all day and not do anything. And that never happened to me, ever. And by the grace of God, it never will. But to people with bipolar disorder, it does happen. And they take SSRIs and they take seriously powerful antidepressants to get them out of those depressive lows. But then they get to the manic highs and the drugs are basically pushing them ever higher. And the side effects catch up to them very quickly. And then they're like, oh shit, I gotta get off these drugs. So they stop taking them. And when they stop taking them, that's when the depression hits them so hard. I mean, to a degree you wouldn't even believe. This cycle with my coworker, and eventually he became something of a friend, carried on for years. And I remember coming back in early 2015 from a family 2016, excuse me, from a family vacation, from 2 weeks off, you know, my usual Christmas and New Year's break with my family. And I came back into the office, and the first thing I heard when I came back was, dude, this guy's dead. It's like, what? He committed suicide. He jumped off the George Washington Bridge. I went to his funeral service pretty much later that day. And the news spread around the office like wildfire. And the reason he did it was because he just couldn't take it anymore. He couldn't take the lows, and he couldn't take his medicine anymore. These medicines are designed to help us, supposedly. But in reality, they're doing a lot to harm us. It's the same with vaccines. Now, let me be very clear about something. I want to make this absolutely clear. I am not anti-vaccine at all. Anyone who says that vaccines in general don't work as a broad statement doesn't know what he's talking about. And he's a moron and a fool and a liar. You shouldn't listen to him. Anyone who says, I'm a bit skeptical about giving blanket immunization to children at the age of 2, he's got a good point. Why? Because children's immune systems aren't developed at the age of 2. Before the age of 2, I should say. Giving a child a very potent vaccine for measles, mumps, and rubella at that point is not a good idea. There's a reason why, before 1988 or thereabouts, those vaccines were administered at a much later stage in a child's life. And there's a reason why it's a good idea to hold off on administering very powerful vaccines until much later. Anyone who says that vaccinations, in general, are wrong is a moron. We've eradicated smallpox, more or less, from the earth because of vaccines. Jonas Salk, the man who, I think it's Jonas Salk, who came up with the very first vaccine, is a hero and a legend and deserves to be lauded as such. We've mostly eradicated polio from the world because of the oral vaccine that's given to kids. We are able to defend ourselves against the worst of influenza most years, not all of them, but most years, which comes back to the Kung Flu pandemic, which is still raging around the world. We're being told that there's a vaccine crash developed which will hopefully fix this problem. I am extremely skeptical about that. Why? Because the clinical data indicate that something like half the people who were given this vaccine developed serious adverse reactions. And now the company behind developing this vaccine has apparently been granted blanket immunity from any side effects that might occur. Now, why would a drug company with billions and billions of dollars behind it need blanket immunity from administering a vaccine? Maybe because either the vaccine doesn't work, or the vaccine has such nasty side effects that it cannot be safely administered. Remember, these are the same drug companies, in general, and I'm painting with a very broad brush, I'll admit that, who have marketed drugs to the rest of us that are deeply dangerous, and that have marketed them as cures when, in fact, much of the time, they are poison. These are the same drug companies that told us that statins would fix our cholesterol issues and would solve the problem of heart disease. They do absolutely nothing of the sort. These are the same drug companies that came along and told us that Viagra and Cialis and whatever else, there's some other drug on the market. I forgot the name. I used to be well-versed in this stuff, I'm not anymore. All of these drugs were safe and recommended for men in low dosages and would solve the problem erectile dysfunction. That's what Florida suffers from, erectile dysfunction. Would solve the problem of erectile dysfunction forever. But they don't. And in fact, there are alternatives out there which are much cheaper, much more useful, and much more safe. There's an alternative out there for dealing with the Kung Flu. COVID-19 can be dealt with, and this is information that, you know, is censored by YouTube, is censored by the news media. Nobody wants you to hear it. But there's increasing weight of evidence that tells us that when you combine hydroxychloroquine with azithromycin, zinc, and vitamin C, you get a battery of cheap, reliable, effective drugs with well-known side effects that will eradicate this virus, more or less, very quickly and very effectively. How does it work? Okay. Yet again, for the umpteenth time, not a doctor, not claiming to be one. If I'm wrong about this, hey, I'm wrong, it's my fault, I'm really sorry. Okay? Go out there and check the information for yourself. My understanding of how the hydroxychloroquine stuff works is that it basically blocks the spike protein that is on the surface of the coronavirus cell packet from interlocking with the cell receptors of the lungs, and therefore cannot inject its viral payload into that cell to force it to replicate and then self-destruct, which is what viruses do. In the process, coronavirus also introduces a number of potential side effects, and the body floods the lungs with fluid in order to deal with the virus itself. And what happens when you have a respiratory infection is your lungs get flooded with mucus, which is intended to trap the foreign agents in there. Well, when you're breathing into your lungs and you get bacteria coming in, the bacteria will sit in that fluid and infect in a very different way from the way that viruses infect. And you'll end up catching bacterial pneumonia, which is a secondary killer. COVID-19 is less of a primary killer than it is a secondary killer. And what that means is that COVID-19 weakens your immune system and compromises your lungs to the point where other infections can get in and sit in that fluid, that goop that's in your lungs, and kill you much more quickly that way, because that will make the problem even worse. Your body overreacts to it and causes the much-feared cytokine storm, where it literally, the body's immune system just goes haywire and starts attacking your own body, and your organs shut down and you die. Azithromycin is a well-known penicillin-based, okay, I could be wrong about that, don't quote me on that, it's a well-known antibiotic. I'm not going to claim it's penicillin-based, I don't know, okay? So I take that back. But it's a well-known, relatively mild, relatively speaking, antibiotic. The usage of azithromycin ensures that the lungs remain somewhat clear and that the bacterial infections in the lungs get killed off, and the body's immune system is able to fight off that infection, and basically you're able to keep breathing. Zinc, I forget exactly what zinc does in the whole process, but there's some purpose designed to, again, complement what hydroxychloroquine is doing, and vitamin C is there to boost cell repair and boost your body's immune system. All of this has been anecdotally verified by thousands of doctors around the world who are administering hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin, zinc, and vitamin C to their patients. There's a doctor named Stella Emanuel who, she made headlines because she went on a rant, basically, in front of Capitol Hill. And it was a bit unhinged and it was a bit over the top. Okay, fine. I mean, her message was lost in the raving loony, arms-waving stuff, and the Daily Mail and all the other tabloids went to great lengths to point out, oh, this is a woman who believes that AIDS is a curse, is a demonic curse, and that homosexual sex is evil. I don't go quite that far, but I will absolutely argue that male homosexuality is a disease-ridden, horrible lifestyle. The evidence about that is absolutely indisputable. And I will also go on record as stating that AIDS, HIV, was originally called gay-related immunodeficiency disease, GRID. And it was very clearly a disease that affected gay men. And that became absolutely clear from the origins of the disease back in the late 60s and early 70s. That was well known. AIDS, as a disease, is primarily dangerous only to gays. And its transmission to heterosexuals is relatively limited, but you know, that's another story. But her presentation was a bit over the top and a bit wild and so on, but that doesn't change the accuracy of her message. That doesn't change the fact that beneath all the sensationalist headlines about how hydroxychloroquine is all unapproved and dangerous and so on, well, hydroxychloroquine may well be ineffective, but as Dr. Emanuel pointed out, I think rightly, do we really have to wait for clinical trials when double-blind studies, when the entire standard of government approval of medicine and treatment thus far has been decidedly half-arsed? As I told you earlier, the entire reason we have a so-called low-fat, high-carb diet as standard these days is because we didn't follow the science. George McGovern never followed the science. So why should we expect government to start doing so now? Anyway, I'm about out of time, and it's going to be a very, very busy day today. You're listening to this on a Sunday, but this was actually recorded earlier, and it's going to be kind of crazy today. So I'm going to leave off here. Many thanks for listening in. I hope this has been somewhat enlightening and useful and helpful to you. Please leave your thoughts in the comments below. I'm sure some of you listening to this will be outraged because I'm promoting quackery and stupidity and untested cures. Well, guess what? A lot of what I am talking about is actually, pretty much everything I'm talking about, is actually science-based. It's right there in the literature. You just have to go look for it. And as always, I think the key lesson to understand is don't trust people just because they have credentials. Don't trust big pharma companies just because they market you something. Don't trust anything that you can't at least get a second opinion about and get an informed opinion about. So, there's a lot more to it than that, but that I think is the best advice I can offer for now. Please check out superbshaving.com. Please check out the blog. There will be various affiliate links posted whenever I finally get around to migrating the stupid thing. I just wish I found the time and wasn't constantly bloody interrupted by various nonsense. Stop by didactsreach.blogspot.com for as long as it's still up, and eventually you'll get redirected to didacticmind.com. Stop by superbshaving.com, buy some stuff off of Amazon through my affiliate links, and you can ensure that I keep doing this. This is Didact, and this was episode 42, Poison is the Cure. And Didact signing off.